Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler and former New York City prosecutor. And today I have with me...
Laura Richards, founder and director of Paladin, National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And Lisa Zambetti, casting director of Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my colleague, and I cast victims and killers and everything in between.
Today we're going to start a new topic on this podcast. We're going to go into the series People versus O.J. Simpson. And what's amazing about this case is that it is something that most of the people in the United States, if not around the world, were aware of when it went on. But what we found during the course of this was that there was a major division within the country between people who believed that O.J. was not guilty and people who believed he was. If you look at it based on the evidence, people seem to go one way. If you look at it based on emotion or race, people seem to go another way. So it was a very divisive case. And in my mind, it was for two reasons. One, it's very difficult to convict a celebrity of anything. They have money. They have fame. They have, especially when you have somebody who's charismatic, they have
special treatment.
Yes.
And they can afford the best defense.
Or five of them, for example.
The scheme team.
Or seven. Yeah.
And they're also used to being in the public eye. They know how to comport themselves.
Yeah. So there are certain benefits that seem to inure when you have money and fame. And I think in this case, we saw the results of that. So we're going to start talking today about episode one.
I actually want to jump back and ask you guys where you were when this all kind of broke. Was it on your radar at all? What did you think when you first heard about the killing and all that? Were you aware of it, Laura?
I was definitely aware of it. I was at the university at the time, studying for my psychology and sociology, my first degree. But I think that it was something, obviously, over here that got a huge amount of coverage on every station, wasn't it?
And oh, yeah.
It didn't get quite the same coverage back at home. And then obviously as things played out, I remember definitely watching the trial. And certainly what stood out was the last part of the judgment and seeing OJ's face. That was the thing that really resonated with me. But probably over here it would be maybe the Bronco and the chase with LAPD in hot pursuit and how that played out.
Well, at the time I was already a New York City prosecutor and I had moved on to the FBI, and I was actually in Little Rock, Arkansas as one of the lead investigators in the Whitewater investigation against President Clinton. So I was there. I'd been there for a few months when this went down. When the Bronco chase happened, or we call it the slow Bronco chase, I was just really confused by why that was going on, because it certainly wasn't any kind of law enforcement reaction that I had ever seen before in my life. And I think part of that, again, had to do with celebrity and race. I think recently the Rodney King acquittal had occurred, and the riots that followed, I think they decimated many parts of Los Angeles and certainly just almost destroyed any credibility the Los Angeles Police Department had with the community. I think that was a major factor. And I think also celebrity of O.J. Simpson was a major factor. Remember, this guy is somebody that the police loved to hang out with.
Yeah.
He was kind of a cop buff. He loved to hang out with cops, and they loved to hang out with him. And I think that because of that, he got extremely special treatment. I mean... I am not somebody who advocates violence. I'm not somebody who advocates even the death penalty. But I think any other circumstance, if it wasn't O.J. Simpson, that if a guy is a fugitive from justice, clearly a fugitive from justice, who was supposed to turn himself in and now is in a Bronco traveling down an interstate towards Mexico, at some point, and as it turns out, he's got $8,700 in cash, a fake beard, a fake mustache, and glue, and his passport.
And he's got a gun,
right?
Well,
so, yeah.
I was just
risk
gonna say,
to self, risk
right.
to he's, others, yeah. public protection issue.
He's got a gun, and he says he's, or AC says he's pointing it at his head, But it is a risk, a major danger. And he's driving up and down the highways, and people are stopping their cars. They're getting out. They're cheering him on. All this stuff is going on. This is not the fact that the police were driving 30 or 40 miles an hour behind him, blocking off the highway in front of him, letting him roam wherever the hell he wanted.
Someone with nothing left to lose. I mean, that's a very dangerous person.
What would normally happen, Jim?
There's a very small difference between homicidal and suicidal ideation. Mm. And both of them are killing humans. And what would normally have happened, they would have thrown tire-bursting tracks on the road. They would have blown out all his tires. They would have stopped the vehicle, and then they would have, at gunpoint, gotten him out of that vehicle. If he did not drop the weapon, they would have ended up shooting him. That's what would have happened in normal circumstances. I'm not saying that that should have happened, but I'm telling you that this is what would have happened, perhaps because of Rodney King, and almost certainly that and the celebrity of O.J. Simpson is why he survived that chase and why he's alive today.
So the perfect storm, effectively. I mean, it's a storm that you couldn't really make up when you add these things together. And we haven't, you know, started to get into the history of what was going on. But certainly anybody who, you know, is suicidal can become homicidal. And, you know, that's exactly what we see here. And he's a complete public protection risk. So for me, it was just staggering watching that latitude. And he's allowed to, as he says, he was going to Nicole's grave, but that certainly didn't play out that he was going to her grave. He was on the run. He was a fugitive fleeing. And as you quite rightly said, Jim, he had a stash of things in his car, and he also had a boat ready for him down in the Bahamas, ready to go. So I think it's very clear what his intent was, but obviously it was flipped round, as we saw throughout the whole trial, flipped round and spun to be seen as something else.
Right. And I think that there's, as we get into the series, we'll talk more about how he was treated and what actually went on and the fact versus fiction of this series and of what the defense was. But I think I do also recall specifically where I was when the verdict came down.
Me too.
I was in Fort Marcy Park, outside of Washington, D.C., where Vince Foster had committed suicide. And myself and the other investigators that were actually doing a metal detector search of that park for the bullet that killed Vince Foster. We searched the entire fort that was there. We searched, we dug up any metal artifacts that we could find. We found dozens of Civil War rounds and Civil War artifacts, as well as current modern rounds as well. We found one round that looked like it was fired from the same kind of gun that Vince Foster had, but we weren't able to metallurgically match it to the other bullets that were in his gun, that were left in his gun. So we couldn't say for certain that that was the round, whether that was the round or not. But then later, many years later, actually, the technology, it turns out the science behind the metallurgical matching of bullet rounds was actually sort of undermined and actually is now not used at all. So it's possible we had found the round. Anyway, what we did was we did a comprehensive investigation, myself, and we brought in Dr. Henry Lee.
I think this is another podcast, isn't it?
No, but this is connecting.
Dr. Lee came in to do forensics testing with me on this case, and we were able to determine how Vince Foster got the gun from his house into his car and into Fort Marcy Park. And we actually put to bed that case for the first time, and we conclusively concluded that it was a suicide at his own hand and that there was nobody else involved in that. So, which was a major thing, because people thought that maybe the White House was involved in killing him and making it look like a suicide. So anyway, Dr. Lee was with me at the time, and he had testified in the trial.
He was a very important witness
in the O.J. Simpson trial. And when we get to it, we'll talk about why he was testifying, what he testified about, and whether or not that was a good thing or a bad thing, I guess.
So you really knew him, and so you really can attest to. He's professional. He's completely.
Oh, absolutely.
He's one of the leading, most world-renowned criminologists. Well, criminalist,
yeah,
isn't he, as you say it over here.
Right. He is the world-renowned criminalist. And he.
We don't have that title back in the UK, interestingly.
Well, basically, probably because it's a very general title. He is an expert in so many fields. They don't name just one of them. I mean, he is a forensic scientist.
But I think it's right to have that title, actually, Jim. I think it makes sense, given his expertise. Mm-hmm. So, and a lot of titles do translate back at home. So, mm-hmm. I'm sure we will be seeing very soon the title criminalist, the same as criminal behavioral analyst is a title in the US and also in the UK.
Right. I mean, people use the short form profiler, and that's why it's part of our title of this podcast, because it's more well known. But what we are, Laura and I, are criminal behavioral analysts. And it takes a very specific amount of education, training, and experience around law enforcement, around violent crimes, around sexual crimes, to become a criminal behavioral analyst.
Okay, so those were that's where you were when that very iconic Bronco chase happened and when the verdicts came down. And I was in New York at the time, and you could not go anywhere without the trial being on in any place. Everybody was talking about it, following it.
What were you doing at the time, Lisa?
I was peeking out of my crib looking at the TV. No, I'm just kidding. I was in New York trying to be an actor, stomping up and down Broadway. But everybody that I knew was following it. It was on in every restaurant, and anywhere you went, it was on the TV. So my dear colleagues here at Real Crime Profiles, we have our disagreements about the merits of making a murderer as a documentary, but I think we are in complete agreement that The People versus OJ is not a documentary by any standard. But it is very interesting, a way to sort of re-examine the events as they happened and compare fact and fiction.
Yeah, I think the thing that struck me the first as watching episode one was that they picked and choose what perspective they would show. Now, they did try to balance it a little bit. They did try to show a little bit of the negative side of OJ, as well as the positive side of OJ, as well as his defense team and the people around him. But I think it's very clear that they did not show a consistent perspective. In other words, some of the things that they talked about or had acted out were things that they could never have known, and then they assumed or inferred or implied other things that they could never have known. And so it's a story.
Mm-hmm. And that's an important kind of differentiation to make, because there are parts that are accurate, that are lifted straight from the trial and from the transcript. And then there's other parts where it's maybe just OJ on his own in a room, where who knows exactly what exactly went on or what he was thinking or doing. Only he knows that.
Well, they pulled from many sources, not just Jeffrey Toobin's book, but a lot of memoirs. Oh, my gosh, there are so many books that were generated from this trial. Mm. It's incredible. So I know they pulled from a lot of those sources, but those are very subjective sources.
Yeah, but OJ himself, you know, is the one person who knows in some of those scenes. And you know, did they consult with him? Who were they actually consulting with? And we've got to remember the younger generation, and certainly people who I've been talking to, you know, in their early 20s and friends, you know, younger, have no understanding of the OJ case at all.
Right.
So them watching this, it's being memorialized as this is now fact.
Right, and here's the problem. When you do lift actual transcripts from the trial and actually what went on, and there's documented evidence of how it went down during the trial, then people think that that same level of scrutiny and accuracy and historical fact, it goes through the rest of it.
Yeah,
and as
true.
Laura said, it becomes fact. It's almost like watching, you know, a film about JFK, and where there's wild conspiracy theories that have been projected throughout, and thinking that's actually what happened, when it's literally the writers and directors getting together and saying, let's make the most dramatic thing we can. And that's exactly what this series is doing. Although they are weaving the story around some fact that occurred in front of the cameras in the courtroom.
And I think they're also trying to, I mean, I worked for the executive producer, so I was very interested to see what he would do with this story. I mean, he is commenting that these characters were larger than life, you know, and so he's sort of, the performances are larger than life. I mean, I think John Travolta's eyebrows will get an Emmy for their performance in this.
Lack of facial movement.
I mean, they don't move at all. What are you talking
moves.
About?
I love it.
Botox. I mean, talk about a Botox commercial.
I mean, oh my gosh, okay. Yeah. Well, anyway, but I love Sarah Paulson. I just want to say I love Sarah Paulson's portrayal of Marshall Clark. Sterling K. Brown, who was actually on Criminal Minds last year, he's doing an amazing job as Chris Darden.
Why didn't Shapiro's eyebrows get the kind of coverage that Marshall Clark's hair did? Yeah. Why is it that her dress?
We're going to get into that, Jim.
All right, asking the question.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, they're right questions to ask, yes. Along with, you know, we're talking about the characters that are in the show, but for me, the victims were totally absent. Yeah. And I know we're going to discuss victimology, but I just think, and I feel for the families, that they just seem to be a sidebar or sideshow issue. And, you know, that's something that Jim and I obviously would cover in a lot of detail. If you understand how somebody lived, you understand how they die. And I just feel this show, you do not get to any understanding about who Nicole and Ron really were as to how they ended up being murdered in this, horrific way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. And that's one of the things that I was talking about, because of the fact that they have taken a perspective which is very OJ-centric and very Dream Team-centric, that you lose any kind of foundation of these victims. You don't know anything about what they did the day before or what their lives were like or what their families were like. What you see in the first episode is that Nicole and Ron are killed and that Nicole's babies are sleeping in their bed, that she had drawn a bath and lit some candles and had some ice cream in a bowl downstairs, and her life just was ended. I mean, brutally ended. And that's all you know about her until a later episode when she's just trashed up and down. I mean, it's
trashed
really...
Trashed by the defense of using names to describe her to suit their case, but no real understanding that she was a mother, a wife, a best friend, a sister, a daughter, and you just don't get that sense of her.
Right. I mean, there's little tiny snippets and hints of what life was like with her, but certainly there was no attempt at all in the first six episodes that we've seen so far to actually get to know who she was. It's unconscionable.
And the same with Ron. But of course, Nicole was the primary victim in this and Ron was secondary. But unfortunately, he ends up being sort of dropped from the whole narrative entirely. Mm-hmm. And I thought what was good about it was when the father, the character in the show, made that very clear of trying to redress a balance. So, you know, I can only feel for the victims, their families, the people who have to sit there and knowing this show's coming and feel that their loved ones are not being fairly represented or given a voice, even from the show within the show.
Yeah, right. Even to this day, Ron Goldman is always referred to as, you know, Nicole Brown Simpson and her friend, Ron Goldman. Like, he's right. Always subordinated in that sort of...
Well, it's very weird because there's been very little to document what that meant, her friend. I mean, what does that even meant? It's an implication and so forth. They could have had very little knowledge of each other other than he actually may have just gone there to give the
glasses
back. But when we get to episode 4, we'll talk about that, because I do think that episode with Ron's father and the emotional statement that he made was probably the best scene in this entire series so far. It was really an amazingly good portrayal. So
it's very poignant. Yeah. Mm.
If we get back to episode 1, so they show the crime scene. Do we want to talk about that right now?
Well, prior to that, remember, if we rewind, it was actually they start with Rodney King.
Mm-hmm.
And that context is really important because I think it takes everyone back to that time. And it's really important that, you know, the zeitgeist, the feeling, because this is everything about what happened with the trial. You know, was probably in most viewers' mind of what actually happened. And then they throw to the dog walker and finding of Nicole's body. Mm-hmm. And, of course, her own dog being there with blood on his paws.
Yeah, the plaintiff wail of the Akita, right? That's how they start the timeline. But the problem is when you talk about the forensics and the crime scene, I did, since I was working with Dr. Lee at the time, he did share with me the crime scene photos at the time. And I can tell you, I've seen thousands, literally thousands of different crime scene photos. And these were some of the most disturbing photos I've ever seen in my life. Just horrific violence on both victims.
Excessive, Jim. I mean, it's totally
absolutely.
Excessive.
And the kind of thing that we say is rage. We say is directed at somebody. It's usually indicative of a personal relationship and usually indicative of an offender or offenders who have violent outbursts of rage, who
explosive.
Are very physically violent and who are emotionally violent. And I think that just looking at the crime scene there, when you profile back to the kind of offender, we would expect the person who did this to have a history of violence, to have a history of violence targeted at these particular victims, and to have a reason to do it. This was not a random act of violence. This was not a robbery gone bad. This is not a drug deal gone bad. This is a rage-fueled attack that was targeted at this victim. Mainly, it looks like it was targeted at Nicole. She did receive more extensive injuries. And
it was almost, her head was decapitated.
It was almost. I mean, the knife actually nicked her, had gone through the front of her throat and went all the way through to the back and nicked her spinal column. But there's also indicators that the offender or offenders, and I'll say that a lot, by the way, during the course of this podcast or these podcasts, but that the person actually stuck the knife in her neck and in Ron's neck and lifted them up with the knife.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry.
It's not a pretty thing. But that is apparently what happened with the forensic show. And that is a very extremely brutal, heartless, almost inhuman thing to do.
And it's up close and personal contact. You know, this is bloody and wet work. This is somebody getting close to the victim, rage, anger. This is revenge. This is taking it out on somebody and brutalizing them in this way.
Absolutely. And somebody who wasn't afraid of getting his hands dirty, somebody who wanted to be there up close and personal, to be able to look in the eyes or whisper in the ears of the people that he was killing. This is a very extremely brutal act. This is what the trial should have focused on instead of the incredibly just bullshit crap that went on in this trial.
I got to tell you guys listening, my skin is absolutely crawling right now. I mean, hearing you talk about that, wow.
But this is the hard truth.
No, I know. This is exactly,
exactly what the trial should have been about. As Jim said, all the nonsense and the white noise around it,
exactly.
And we forget, it means it distracts and it detracts from what actually happened. Two people were brutally murdered in cold blood, in full vision of others, because this is, you know, almost on the street.
And
she's come down from her condo.
Yeah, I have
and
so many
shame.
Questions about this
yeah,
for you.
Shame on the news agencies that started talking about Marsha Clark's dress and hair. Shame on the defense team who basically made a mockery of the justice system. Shame on the people who just totally disrespected these victims and allowed injustice to happen just for their own fame, just for their own pockets getting rich. It's
based on what you saw. Could you tell like how big the person was and anything else about the suspect killer?
Well, to tell you the truth, the main issue with respect to this is when you have somebody who kills two different people in the same incident. I mean, it's difficult to control two adults. And
or to
especially,
control one.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, what I'm saying is it's difficult to control two adults. So it's likely that if they were controlled, either this person has a weapon, a gun to keep them controlled, or that there's more than one person involved. And I know that if you get into the forensics that were discussed during the course of the trial, you'll find that Dr. Lee had postulated that Ron Goldman was being held from behind, pinning his arms to his sides, and he's kicking with his feet. Now, he's trained in karate. He's a big guy, strong, athletic, and the stab wounds that went into his legs and thighs, based on the positioning of his jeans at the time, you could tell that his legs were up and bent at the time that the knife went into his legs. So, and this is on both legs, so I think Dr. Lee postulated that somebody had to have been holding him from behind.
And the other thing is, Jim, he had bruises on his hands. He made contact physically with whoever it was. And so there is also the school of thought that whoever he was fighting back, being over 6 foot and being strong and trained in karate, they would have had bruises on them too.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's possible. But there's also the fact that they were on a concrete stairway and concrete walkway, and it looks like they both got blunt force trauma to the head before they were stabbed. So he could have been basically blitz attacked from behind or the front and knocked down and fallen down the stairs or fallen over the railing or whatever it was to end up in the position that he was in. So I'm not sure if he punched them or he banged into the railing and the steps and to the sidewalk and the fence, the metal fence. There's a lot of different ways that could happen. But the fact is that it looks like, according to what Dr. Lee's testimony was, that there's more than one offender.
I want to ask about if you could tell from the pictures, like, who was attacked first or time between do you know what I mean? That
there's a lot of different theories about this. And the best theory that I'm aware of is that they were both knocked unconscious or at least incapacitated before they were actually stabbed. So they were both beat in the head and either knocked out or at least knocked down before they were actually stabbed. Then after having subdued them, the attacker or attackers took them one by one. Ron first, he would have been the greater threat. He's actually karate trained and a bigger man than Nicole was. So physically, he would have been the greater threat. I believe he was then brutally murdered, stabbed multiple times while he was trying to defend himself. During that time, I believe the attacker or attackers were cut because of the fighting back.
Yeah.
And as a result, when you get to Nicole's body, there are blood spatter droplets on her back that were never collected. They were photographed but never collected.
Why weren't they ever collected, Jim?
Because they took her body, laid her on her back in a pool of blood, and then they became just mixed with everything else. But had they been collected at that time,
it was probably the killers.
Yeah, if
one of them.
Yes. If they had collected them then and found, for example, O.J. Simpson's blood droplets on her back, there would never have been a question. It would have been just automatic. But because the crime scene investigators just saw a lot of blood everywhere and they thought, well, that could be her blood. You know, it doesn't matter if we roll her over. It doesn't matter. I mean, they really made some bonehead errors. And we'll talk about this because this case did, in fact, change how law enforcement collected, preserved, maintained chain of custody for evidence from that point forward.
But when she's put in the body bag, then the forensics are lost forever, correct?
Correct.
When she's placed in there.
When she gets in there, I mean, they bring her to the morgue, and then at the morgue, her body is washed. All that evidence is just gone.
Oh,
and the crime scene is washed down 36 hours later.
Is that normal? I mean,
yeah, but it should have been completely forensically tested. It should have been
and preserved
documented
for some time, and on camera, tents put up. I mean, all the things that we know now. But as you said, Jim, this was the case. you know, back in 94 that changed the way crime scenes were processed thereafter here in the States.
One last thing about the crime scene I have a question about in terms of the killer or killers. So this place, it's you can see the porch from the street. I mean, it's not like a covered place.
Well, actually, there's a tree there that provided almost 100% darkness to that area.
Because it seems like you can see through the gate, through the to the walkway.
It's, the gate has sort of wrought iron parallel up and down struts, and then it has like a screen over it. So you can see, but if there's light from the street outside and it hits the front of that gate, you can't really see through it.
But I mean, somebody out there is bold enough to kill them right outside, not like kill her in the house, or do you know what I mean? Does that speak to who the killer is at all, or just seems like?
Well, I think if you actually look at the scene, you'll see that that area was shaded by a tree from the streetlights, and it was very dark, and it would be very easy to hide there and lay in wait and then attack when Ron came to the gate. Nicole had to come out to open the gate, and then they proceeded inside the gate. That's probably where it went and where it happened.
Or perhaps the other way around. I mean, what if she's come downstairs because it's somebody she knows at the door and Ron stumbles upon them? Could have been an option as well. But, I mean, one thing's for sure, the show doesn't really talk about what was going on before, but certainly Nicole had been to dinner, hadn't she?
Yes.
And they'd been to a dance show, and then they had gone to dinner, 11 of them, and I believe that they were going to go to another restaurant, which is OJ's son's restaurant, Jason, and they ended up not going there and actually going to Ron's restaurant instead. So there was a change of plan, and I believe OJ was with her before at the dance show. And then obviously there have been things that happened thereafter, exchanges between OJ and Nicole that we don't know about. Certainly if we believe what her sister says, she was saying that she wanted to get on with her life and didn't want him in it anymore, whilst at the same time he's rejected by Paula,
his girlfriend.
So there's a number of things happening just before we even get to talking about, you know, what was happening at the crime scene.
Yeah.
Certainly then the crime scene side, we know, and I remember looking at the footage and just revisiting it, where you just see so many officers, you know, walking up and down in the crime scene with no protective clothing on, which is just quite incredulous. Every, you know, violation that could have happened did happen.
Right, but this, at that time, DNA was just emerging in these cases. And law enforcement officers were not trained in this. And generally, homicide detectives would come and look at the scene and get their feel for it and find out what they could. But it was just not, the technology was not there. They just didn't have that procedure at the time. And so now we know, because of this case, how defense teams can basically drive trucks through that. So it became a point of training from that point forward.
Yeah, I mean, I do accept that, Jim, but I also think murder cases have been tried since this, you know, before this case, where they must have known certain basic principles. And I heard what Dr. Henry Lee said about it, you know, that basic procedures just weren't followed.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have to think about that because, you know, there were three crime scenes here effectively, weren't there? Her house, then OJ's, and then the Bronco. And you've got the same officers attending each of those scenes, if you like, OJ's house and the Bronco. So you immediately have cross-contamination issues. But I know we're going to get into that in more detail, but I'm not so willing to, to let off when it's the most basic principles. Forget the fancy stuff that we know now, but it's the most basic principles violated.
I think that part of that, goes back to celebrity. I think they knew they were at OJ's ex's house. They knew that she was dead, and they knew that they were going to have to inform OJ one way or the other that this was going to be a major news event. And I think they got a little bit starstruck or clouded by that or put blinders on because of that.
That may well have happened. I mean, certainly, they would have called her in to find out what the history is. And I believe, you know, one or two of them would have known the history because they had attended the address before, because there were 62 incidents prior to this of domestic violence and 8 call-outs just prior. So they must have had an inkling that OJ would be a person worth visiting. And therefore, they should have already been thinking right from the very start, you know, what the next steps are. This is a crime scene that is horrific and it needs to be processed. And then the rest unfolds, you know, right. As we know, and is fairly accurate, isn't it, in the way that the show portrays it.
Well,
some of the details left out, of course.
What they didn't put in was that when they arrived at OJ's house, I mean, the lights were on, there were cars in the driveway. They figured there was probably a maid inside. They got the number from a local security company. They called into the house. Nobody answered the phone. Then Furman finds that drop of blood on the outside of the Bronco, which was kind of haphazardly parked around the curb, around the corner. And they got concerned that, oh my God, what if OJ was actually the target of this violence and they killed his wife first and now they came and got him? So they jumped over the fence, opened it, went to the house, and found that he wasn't there. Later determined that he was in Chicago.
So you think they had cause to do all that? I mean, it's depicted in the show, and I think it's pretty accurate to what really happened, is that they, you know.
Yeah, I think, but the allegation was during the trial that the officers were actually going after him as a suspect at that point, and I believe that it was the exact opposite. Had they been going after him as a suspect, I think they would have been more forensically aware. They would have been, hopefully, would have protected. For example, what they could have done, what they should have done, is worn forensic suits over their suits with booties on that they could take off if they stepped in blood so that they didn't transfer that stuff from the bottom of their shoes to another location. That's one of the gravest risks of cross-contamination that you could have by bringing something from one location to another. But what's clear is that what they didn't do is actually drop OJ's blood somewhere in his house. You know, there were actually droplets of blood there in his house. That's not from a shoe transfer. It's not from them bringing it from the other crime scene. But even if they had, I mean, the absurdity of this, and this is something that I can't understand why jurors couldn't understand this, but the absurdity of thinking that Furman could have planted OJ's blood at the crime scene at Bundy and the glove at the crime scene at Rockingham is this. When Furman arrived at the scene on Bundy, he was the fifth person. There were four other police officers that had got there first, already had seen the one glove and the hat, and before he even arrived there. So there's a theory that, well, there were two gloves there. He picked one up and brought it back with him and dropped it at the other location. But here's something that nobody on the defense could ever answer. How would they get OJ's blood? OJ was in Chicago at this time. How would the police have gotten his blood to put at the crime scene? It's completely impossible. He did not donate his blood earlier. He did not have, you know,
a vial of it
hanging
around.
And
he's in Chicago, so, you know. I mean, the other thing that doesn't make sense is, why frame OJ? I mean, surely there'd be easier people, less likable and easy to frame. I mean, if you the reason picking on Furman, well, we know why. He's the weak link in the case, so they flip it on its head and make it about something else. But I agree with you, Jim. How would they have had OJ's blood?
That's just ridiculous. Dr. Lee approached the LAPD and offered his services. And he said that in his review of the case, it looks like there were two offenders. And he was shut down immediately. He was told, we have the one guy, it's only one guy, go away. And after that, the defense team, they went around the world looking for the best forensic experts, and Dr. Lee is the preeminent criminalist in the world. And so they asked the governor of Connecticut if he could assist them in their case. And being the government, the governor can't say, no, you can't, he can't work for them. And the DA had already said, we don't want you. So he went out to actually look at the evidence at LAPD. And when he got there, he told me that they put him in a lab that had no electricity and broken microscopes, and They were very rude to him, and he was very offended by this. And so the last thing you want to do is piss off the best forensic evidence in the world. And so he came back with his own equipment and his own tests, and he said, I'm going to find every mistake you made. And he did. And that helped tear apart the case that the prosecution put together. I think that was partially due to arrogance on the part of either the LAPD or the district attorney's office who shooed Dr. Lee away. I think the Dream Team even formed with the members that they had because they wanted to shut up other experts that were out talking, like Dershowitz and F. Lee Bailey. So in order not to have them talking out against them, they brought them into the team. And now, attorney-client privilege, they can't make another statement publicly.
You know, the Dream Team or the Scheme Team, because that's what they were, they're playing dirty. They have all these tactics that they're running, and yet, meanwhile, the prosecution
has
are
to
playing
follow the rules.
A clean game. They are following the rules by the book because they have to, and yet they are not playing at an equal level.
Yeah, I have to say that when I was a prosecutor in New York City, one of the judges that I prosecuted cases in front of was Judge Judy Scheindlin. Everybody
Judge
knows
Judy.
Her as Judge
yeah.
Judy. The fact is, she's brilliant. It's no wonder she's like the second wealthiest female in entertainment and entertainment history, next to Oprah. But she knew the law, and she ruled her courtroom with an iron fist. So the prosecutors loved her because the defense could not pull this kind of crap in front of her. If Judge Judy were the trial lawyer instead of Judge Ito, I think we would have had a very different result. The fact is that Judge Ito, and we'll get into this later at the end, we'll probably do a sum up of the different characters in this series, but in the real trial. But Judge Ito made some really bonehead and, you
peculiar
know,
peculiar decisions.
Good Lord.
What you're saying is pretty incredible. That he offered his services first, you know, for the prosecution, and they shooed him away, and then he came right back and worked for the defense.
He's there to process the crime scene.
Right.
I mean, whichever side, you know, and Dr. Henry Lee would say, as Jim and I both know, he is there to process the crime scene and to say what it tells you, whatever it is.
Just so you know, that he was also in the house, in Kardashian's house, when OJ left. When he was supposed to be turned himself in, when he left in the white Bronco chase, Dr. Lee did an exam of OJ's body, found some little cuts on his body that nobody else had known about at that point, and found drops of blood in the house as well. And he turned all that stuff over to the prosecution as well. But by this time, he was actually a defense expert. But what a lot of people don't know is that when OJ disappeared and the cops came to the house to try to find OJ and arrest him, since he was gone, the cops basically felt that the lawyers, and like Shapiro and Kardashian, had helped OJ escape. So they were actually kind of in custody for a while until they found the Bronco was driving and they started following them. But they were actually held for a little while under suspicion.
For aiding and abetting?
Yeah, under suspicion that they helped him escape. So that's a little behind the scene thing that basically happened that nobody really knows about. But, you know, other things, you know, I think they depicted it in the series, OJ taking a polygraph and failing miserably, like failing with the worst possible failing rate, and then an explosive reaction to that when he tries to blame it on, well, of course, I'm emotional because she's dead, you know, that kind of thing. That's why he failed. It's the explosive reaction that I think is consistent with exactly what we saw at the crime scene.
And in fact, that explosive temper that we see throughout the show, you know, this is somebody who reacts quickly. This is somebody who feels that their opinion should count more than anybody else's. And this is somebody who is not used to the word no, who is not used to being rejected, who is used to getting his way, who is very entitled and has been leading the life, you know, of a high-level celebrity where whatever he says goes. And I think that's another important context, because although the show don't really peel back as much as I would have liked about who he is. I think seeing his show and, sorry, seeing his house and the fact that they change the house and redecorate.
Yeah, apparently that is true.
It is true.
Yeah.
Another dirty tactic by the defense.
Should definitely get into that when we get to that episode because that's outrageous. But
well, along with Nicole's house being emptied, so you get no sense when the jury visits of who she is. But the fact that they do portray his explosive temper is a very telling point to me about the type of person that OJ is behind the scenes. Well, and certainly when we listen to the 911 calls, you can hear for yourself exactly what OJ is about in the background when she is on the phone to the police, and he does not fear the consequence at all.
Exactly.
That she is on the phone, and that call handler can hear him, as we all can.
Yeah,
and I think we'll actually go into the details on it. We'll actually go over those calls, those recorded calls later. But what's important about you were talking about the house and the jury's visit to the house and so forth. But what's important and what is also true is that Darden sat on the bench in front of OJ's house, not in the backyard, but in the front. And OJ said, "Get off my bench. I don't want you on my bench." And a little bit of explosive rage. It did actually happen and just shows you how out of control this man is, that knowing that the judge and the jury are all right there, that he is willing to let loose like that. And
he doesn't fear the consequence.
Well,
and is that by the big statue of him in his garden?
No, that isn't where it was. But the fact is that he has had a history of being able to walk away from incidents with the police, even though he pled no contest to beating her earlier. I think it was 5 years earlier.
1989.
Right.
Yeah, so he pled no contest to that, but still there were really no consequences
to him. That's
right,
he did some charity work.
What do we know about people getting away with things?
They keep coming back and doing it again and again and again until they kill the person.
Exactly.
So maybe, gosh, we have so much to talk about. I'm so, oh my gosh, I can't wait to get to it. But I think this might be a good time. This might be a good time to sort of pause, and we'll come back to our conversation in our next episode. My mind is blown already by what you guys have just told me.
So basically, that's our analysis of episode one of People versus O.J. Simpson. And I think a couple of things that we learned are that the show, although it does have some basic facts about what was going on in the trial, that it didn't really maintain any kind of historical accuracy with respect to many of the other conversations and issues and events that went on. They totally seemed to brush over and not even be concerned about telling the story of the victims. And that, yes, there were definitely basic forensic evidentiary collection issues that were not followed at all. Like the spots of blood on the droplets and of blood spatter on the back of Nicole that were never collected and elsewhere, and that the prosecution immediately seemed to assume that there was one perpetrator and did not at all investigate other options there. People like AC, people like OJ's
sons, which we will talk about,
are other potential offenders that they did not even look at. So we will continue to follow this series with other episodes of our podcast. And for now, we're going to wrap up. And I just want to tell you that if you haven't been listening to Bob Ruff's Truth and Justice podcast, you should. It's an amazing podcast. He is now doing it full time. He has actually retired from the fire department,
He's
spending all his time doing investigations, like ground-sourced investigations with listeners. I think it's an amazing thing.
He's an incredible advocate.
I have to say that when I met Bob, like we got to meet him, was it like a month ago or something?
Yeah, when he came here.
He walked in the door. I didn't know he was coming, and I screamed. It was like I was meeting the Beatles.
It was kind of weird, I have to say, because I told her Bob was coming.
I didn't know that Bob.
I know.
You just said
and
Bob. My dad's name's Bob. I'm like, I don't know who Bob is.
No, so she was very, very nonplussed about it. She was like, okay, whatever. Somebody else is coming. Good Lord. And I walk in the door with him, and it's the first time I ever saw somebody instantly melt.
Oh, Chloe. And
she was
like,
starstruck.
Who the hell is this girl? Anyway, So anything I just else to recommend?
Yeah, that's it. For this one.
Laura?
Yeah, I'd like to make a recommendation for anybody who is currently being victimized, a victim of domestic abuse, or any family members who want to try and get help to their loved one, whether you're a family member or a friend. I know a lot of Nicole's family and friends have always said, how did they miss it? How did they miss these warning signs? So one of the things that you can do is look at the DASH risk checklist. And the DASH stands for the Domestic Abuse, Stalking and Harassment and Honour-Based Abuse Risk Assessment and Management Model, which I created on behalf of ACPO, which was the Association of Chief Police Officers, and also a charity called Safe Lives. And it is a 27-item questionnaire, and victims or family members can complete it online. So please do have a look at the website www.-riskchecklist.co.uk. And for those who feel they are experiencing stalking, please do have a look at Paladin's website, www.paladinservice.co.uk. That's the National Stalking Advocacy Service. They do fantastic work, and you know, they can't do enough to support and hear victims of stalking and make sure their voice is heard. So you can also make a donation if you would like to. So that's on the Paladin National Stalking Advocacy website.
Oh my God, I don't know how to follow that, because that is such an important resource. But I do have a plug for, it's springtime, and pitchers and catchers are meeting. My husband's laughing that I even said that. I want to plug a podcast called Sully Baseball Podcast, which is a wonderful podcast. If you or someone you love loves baseball, please check it out. It's produced by our producer, Paul Francis Sullivan, who is an incredible podcaster, and he recently got back from London, where he interviewed people from the British Baseball Foundation and all that stuff. So anyway, check out his podcast. Hopefully soon Jim and his father will be on the podcast, because Jim's father is...
He was Pete Clemente, and he was a pitcher. He was on the Pittsburgh Pirates AAA farm team. He went to St. Mary's College in California, did some semi-pro baseball out here in California, but he grew up in New York City, Cardinal Hayes High School, and pitched there. So he has a little bit of baseball history in that he played with people like Mickey Mantle and Billy Martin and Yogi Berra and those guys. So
yeah, a much lighter podcast subject, but check it out if you can. And continue to talk to us on Facebook. We're having some great conversations with some of you guys on Facebook. Thank you for your questions and contributions to that. And,
all right, so till next time.
For advice or support, if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0207 840 8960 or go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter, safety or counselling, call the Genesis 24-hour hotline 214-946-4357 or go on the website www.genesisshelter.org, or you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline on 800-799-7233.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan, engineered by Jacob Moose Molin. Music is composed and performed by Simba Sumba. Logo art by Rob Cohen. Real Crime Profile is produced and recorded at Empire Studios LA by XG Productions.